All right. Well, hey, everybody. It's great to see you today. I'm Glenn Barnes, one of the pastors here, and I'm so glad that you joined us for our online worship service today, and look forward to sharing this message with you. So there's this important little phrase in John chapter 4 that actually reveals a lot about the character of Jesus, even though you could argue that this little phrase is not entirely true. Now, you may say, okay, preacher boy, which part of the Bible are you saying isn't true? And it actually takes place at a time right before Jesus has this famous encounter with a woman at the well. And Jesus appears to this woman, and he shows such grace and love to a person that a lot of especially kind of respectful Jewish men would not have even paid any attention to. After all, this woman had three strikes before Jesus even says hello to her. First of all, she is a woman. Second of all, she is Samaritan. Samaritans were a mixed race of people that most Jews looked down on as kind of half-breeds and even as enemies of the Jews. Third, she was known for her sinful past. She'd been married five times before, and the man that she was even with at this point wasn't her husband. And yet Jesus goes up to her and has this surprising conversation with this woman. And among other things, he reveals to her that he is the Messiah, which he doesn't do to a whole lot of other people. And eventually, this woman becomes someone who shares the good news of who he is all around that part of Samaria. So you may say, okay, so which part isn't true then? Well, it's actually a little phrase in John leading up to this whole experience, where John tells us that Jesus and his disciples had been in the southern part of Israel in Judea, and that he was going north up to the northern part of Israel into Galilee. And so what it says is in John 4:4, that for him to go from Judea to Galilee, it says he had to, Jesus had to go through Samaria. Now, technically, that's not true. Jesus didn't have to go through Samaria. Now, it would have been the shortest and the quickest route for him to go from Judea to Galilee through Samaria, but it was a route that he didn't have to go. In fact, most respectful Jews, and especially most rabbis, actually took a route where they would go east across the Jordan River, and then they would go north, and then they'd come back across. That way, they never had to set foot in the enemy territory of Samaria. So the reality is that Jesus didn't have to go through Samaria because of the geography, but Jesus had to go through Samaria because of his mission. And because he did, he helped tear down barriers that had stood for generations, and he also helped to transform this person's life. And so here's the point. Jesus could have avoided the whole thing if he wanted to by just taking the safe and the easy route around Samaria. But because he knew that changes needed to be made, he was compelled to go through a place that many people would consider either unsafe or at the very least would have considered it very distasteful. Well, today, for all of us, it would be easier for us to just avoid the issue that we need to talk about. After all, dealing with racism can be a difficult topic. It can feel very uncomfortable. At times, it can even feel divisive. Sometimes we don't know the right thing to say, or we don't know the right way to say it. And yet today, because of the mission of Christ on our lives as followers of Christ and as a church that wants to honor and love all people that Jesus gave his life for, we are compelled to talk about this important topic. And so today's message is called The Third Option, Hope for a Racially Divided Nation. And it's based in large part on a book that I've been reading by a pastor by the name of Miles McPherson. Miles McPherson is a pastor of a large church down in San Diego, multiracial church called The Rock Church in San Diego. And Miles grew up in Queens, New York, and lived in a predominantly, if not all, black neighborhood. And yet because he was a great athlete, he went to a predominantly white schools. And so he understood growing up with that kind of racial tension. He then played several years in the NFL for the San Diego Chargers before eventually being called to be a pastor. So I would say that the message of this book and the message for us today is really a message that is about our own personal growth and our own personal responsibility. So in other words, it's not so much about political solutions, but it's about our own personal growth. Some may say, well, because of that, this book doesn't go far enough. Some might say on the other side, well, hey, this book goes too far. And I share that with you just to say how challenging this issue can be. Because, you know, right after the death of George Floyd, there was just a very brief moment, where it seemed like America and the world were united. And we were united and we were unified in an outrage that this black man could lose his life in such a horrible and an unnecessary way. And so people on all sides of the issues watched that video, and they were horrified and saddened and called for change and said that something needed to take place for there to be healing for this racial divide that had plagued our nation for far too long. Now, unfortunately, here we are 6 or 7 weeks later, and it seems like that brief moment of unity has again passed, as again, things have become so divided. As in my opinion, we've allowed political extremes on both sides of the agenda to kind of hijack the conversation. And so on the one hand, on the one extreme, you have people that are making it all about tearing down monuments or getting rid of the police, even though we could say that the vast majority of police officers are doing a great job, and they're doing it under difficult circumstances. And they deserve the support and the appreciation for what they do. So that's on the one side. But on the other side, you have people that are pushing back, that saying these painful experiences and these difficult things that we're hearing from our brothers and sisters of color, they're saying, you know, is it really that bad? Is it really true, the things that they're saying? And can't they just get over it so that we can get back to the way things were? So as I said, today's message is not about political solutions, but it's about how each of our lives as followers of Christ can become greater conduits of peace and healing, and how we the church can stand up against racism and learn to love and honor all people, even those that are different from us, those that disagree with us, even those that sometimes might be considered enemies. Because the third option is all about this. The third option is not about me getting my way or you getting your way. The third option is about God's way and learning to honor all people as image bearers of God. So kind of the main text for this book comes from Joshua chapter 5. And in Joshua chapter 5, again, it takes place right before kind of another famous event in the Bible, when Joshua and the people march around Jericho. And so Joshua is leading the Israelites, and he comes one day on a pathway to this man who we find out is the angel of the Lord. And in Joshua 5, 13, we read this. Now, when Joshua was near Jericho, he looked up and he saw a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword in his hand. Joshua went up and asked him, "Are you for us or are you for our enemies?" So in other words, Joshua was seeing everything through this us versus them, are you on my side or my enemy's side mentality. There are only two options. And you know what? We live in that kind of divided times these days, right? Politicians, the media, it seems like everyone wants us to live with this kind of tribalistic us versus them mentality. And we're taught to live in fear and constant suspicion of those who would see things differently than me. And so that was the approach that Joshua takes when he asks the angel of the Lord, are you for us? Are you for me? Or are you for my enemies? And the angel of the Lord answers like this, neither. Neither, he replied, but as the commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come. And Joshua fell face down on the ground in reverence and asked him, what message does my Lord have for his servant? And so in this passage, we see that the commander of the Lord's army, whom many scholars would argue is actually a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ himself, offers Joshua a different way from the cultural traps that says there are only two options, my way, those that are for me, or those that are against me. He gives Joshua a third option, and the third option is the Lord's way. And when it comes to racism, the third option is to learn to honor all people for what we have in common with them more than what we have that is different or what divides us. And so let's jump into kind of the heart of this matter, and let's talk about racism. So racism is defined, kind of a technical definition, as the belief that a particular ethnicity is either superior or inferior to another, and that a person's social and moral traits are predetermined by his or her inborn biological characteristics. Now, I want to just say right up front very clearly that racism is a sin. It was never God's design for people to look down or to oppress other human beings whose genetic makeup, if we're honest, even though they may seem different than us, the genetic makeup is about 99.5% the same. And so racism is a sin against God's design, and yet for generations it has been one of the devil's favorite tools to divide people. And this is true not just in America, but it's true in all different cultures. In fact, I saw this last year when I had the opportunity to visit Rwanda. And if you know the story of Rwanda, you know that it was the site of one of the most horrific racial genocides in the last 100 years. As over 100 days, there were 1 million Tutsis that were slaughtered by the Hutu people. And the Hutu and the Tutsi were tribes that shared Rwanda. And so there was this great racial genocide, and yet I was there years later, and God was doing some amazing things to rebuild this country. And while I was there, I was interested in, what's the difference between a Hutu and a Tutsi? And it was explained to me how they might look a little different or talk a little different. But I'm telling you, for the time that I was there, for the life of me, I could not tell the difference between these two tribes. For the life of me, I couldn't figure it out. And yet there was a time when they figured out how to hate and even show violence against each other before, again, as I said, God has brought some remarkable healing through his power there. And so racism is a sin against God's design, and it's something that the devil uses. Now, with many sins, there are different types of sins, and there are sins of commission, and there are sins of omission. So when it comes to racism, a sin of commission is a sin that is committed, an outward expression. So whether that's speaking harmfully against someone from another ethnic group, whether it's telling an off-color joke, whether it's looking down on someone as not smart or not talented or not skilled in a certain area. Maybe it's showing a preferential treatment either for or against a person. Maybe even committing violence against a person of another race. Those are racial sins of commission, things that can be committed. Now, almost everybody that I would know would say, I am not a racist. And I'm not accusing people of being racist. I think for the most part, we don't intend to be. And there are certainly some people that, have chosen to be racist. But I think most people would say, that's not me. I don't choose to be a racist. But like I said, with all sins, there are sins of commission and there are sins of omission. So when it comes to sins of omission, things we admit or omit, these are things that we don't do or don't say to make things better. These are things we don't say to understand another person that's different than us. Things that we don't do to get to know someone that is a different ethnicity than me. Things that we don't do to love or to empower those that are different from us. And so while most people would say, I'm not racist, and certainly most Christian people would say, hey, that is not in my heart to discriminate against any person, the reality is that Sunday morning in America remains one of the most racially divided times of the whole week. And to me, that has to break God's heart. So sociologists describe this in one way. They talk about what are called in-groups and out-groups. And so in-groups and out-groups are the ways that we tend to sort people into groups that are either like me in my in-group or those that are not like me. So this is exactly what Joshua did when he said, are you for me, those that are in my in-group? Are you for my enemies, those that are in my out-group? This kind of us versus them mentality is the same reason you see high school students, develop into little cliques and either welcome or exclude people based on whether you're in the right group or not. It's why we have gangs that claim this color or that color. It's why politicians, quite honestly, can so effectively demonize people on the other side of the aisle as either evil or scary. Because we all have in us this sinful tendency to see those people as other, and we want to have an in-group and an out-group. So sociologists also talk about something called an in-group bias, which is the tendency to give a preferential treatment to those people that are considered like me. So our in-group could be based on race, but our in-group could be based on anything. It could be based on a common interest we have. We even root for the same sports team. We're of the same profession. We're the same religion. We're the same political party. But let me give you 9 traits of kind of an in-group bias, and we all do this in one form or another. So 9 traits of in-group bias. Number 1, I am more comfortable with those that are like me. I am more inclined to spend time socially with those that are like me. I am more patient. It's easier to just be patient and give the benefit of the doubt to those who are like me. In fact, I give the benefit of the doubt quicker to those that are in my in-group. I express more grace when mistakes are made by those that are like me. It's easier to communicate with those that are like me. I assume that I will get along easier with those that are like me. I'm more willing to go out of my way to help those people that I view as in my in-group, in the same groups as me. And number 9, I possess a more positive assumption about those that are like me. Now, the flip side of that is an out-group bias, which relates to how we perceive and we treat those that we somehow perceive as different for us. So out-group bias says this, that I am less comfortable with those that are not like me. I am less inclined to spend time socially or get to know someone who is not like me. I'm less patient with those that are not like me. I give the benefit of the doubt less to people that are not like me. I express less grace when mistakes are made by someone who's considered in my out-group. It's more difficult to communicate with those that are not like me. I don't assume that I will get along with people that are not like me. I just kind of assume that we're going to be different and we're not going to find anything in common. I'm less willing to go out of my way to help those that are not like me. I possess a less positive assumption about those that are not like me. And you see, in all of us is this tendency to divide everything up in terms of us and them. And unless we recognize this, and unless we call this out, it is going to be continued to be destructive in our lives, in our churches, in our families, and in our nation. You know, as I thought about this week, I was reminded and a little embarrassed about one of the first times that I really remember recognizing this. And this was kind of brought to my mind this week as I was thinking about it. And it was back when I was in elementary school. And I went to, I think, a really great elementary school with a lot of great teachers. It was called Santa Cruz Gardens Elementary School. It was primarily a neighborhood school. And I'm just going off memory, but I would say that Santa Cruz Gardens, when I went there, probably was 80% white. And 80% of the kids came from the neighborhood that I lived in, which, as far as I remember, was predominantly white and made up the majority of the school. But just outside of what I would consider my neighborhood, down at the bottom of the hill, there was this large apartment complex. And this apartment complex was called the Villa San Carlos. And I hadn't thought about this in years, but it came just flooding back to me. And I remember as a kid having some of the other kids in the school talking about those kids from the Villa. And the Villa San Carlos was, just by my memory, made up of probably 80% Hispanic people. The vast majority of those were Mexican. And so I remember learning about those kids from the Villa. And when I heard them talk about this place that literally was only about a mile away from my home, but it might as well have been on the other side of the planet, because it was this mysterious place for me, this scary place, this place where that was unwelcoming, this place that was unfriendly, this place that was poor, this place that was different. And the kids in my school, you know, 80% sat together and played together, and another 20% sat together and played together, and things were separate. And I'll be honest, as I kind of thought back on that experience in my life, it breaks my heart. And it breaks my heart for so many reasons. It breaks my heart that my sinful nature could be so strong that even as a kid, I could so easily believe that lie, right? That I could just buy into that. It breaks my heart because I wonder how many great kids I missed out on knowing because I couldn't see past the color of their skin. I couldn't see past their accent or their address. I think about what great friends or what amazing experiences I missed out on because of this in-group and out-group bias that honestly just came so naturally to me. And it makes me think that there has to be a third option. There has to be a way where I don't see people and we don't see people as for me or against me or in or out, but we see them as God sees them. That we see all people as made in God's image, as all people as valuable, as worthy of Christ laying down his life. And so that's what this third option is all about. And so for the rest of our short time today, what I want to do is I want to talk about some steps that we can take, some simple steps that we can take to be a part of healing this racial division. And again, these are less about political solutions, and these are more about me and you looking in the mirror and say, what are some things that I can do to grow personally, to be a part of the solution rather than to be a part of the division? Number one is this. I can acknowledge my blind spots in my life, and I can acknowledge those by listening and learning. So we all understand what a blind spot is. A blind spot is something that we know that it's there, but I just can't see it because it's in a place that my view can't normally see it. So in your car, when a person or another car is in your blind spot, you can't see it, and sometimes you turn into that and it can create a big problem, right? That's why a lot of new cars come with blind spot indicators, something that lights up that says, you know what, hey, there's another car, there's another person that is in your blind spot. So when it comes to issues of race, we need some blind spot indicators, because the truth is we can only know what we know. We can only know what we've experienced on our experiences. And so those blind spot indicators come when we are willing to listen and learn even beyond our experiences and beyond the only things that we know. If we only know people and we spend the vast majority of our time with our in-group, we're not going to understand people that we would put in our out-group, right? And so we would have blind spots towards them, and so they would seem scary. For me as a kid, the kids from that apartment complex seemed scary, and I missed out on the blessing of knowing them. But I also think of the damage that was done to that, and I'm just heartbroken to think that perhaps because of my prejudice, that I unwillingly contributed to the difficulty of someone that was already in a tough situation, someone that was already an immigrant, someone that was already a second language kid, and they were trying to make it in white America. And for whatever reason, I couldn't be welcoming. And I think of how I could have perpetuated that cycle by having those blind spots. You know, there's another time in my life when I experienced this, quite honestly, in a much more systematic and even a more wicked way than that, if you can imagine. When I was in high school, for whatever reason, I had this idea that I wanted to be an exchange student. And I don't know why, but it just seemed interesting to me. I have always been interested in other cultures and other people. And so I applied with the local Rotary Club to be an exchange student, and I was accepted to be a Rotary exchange student. And they decided that they were going to send me, I was 15 years old, and they were going to send me for a year to live in Johannesburg, South Africa. So in 1985, when this happened, obviously this was going to be a big cultural shift. South Africa is literally on the other part of other side of the world. But in 1985, when I went to live in Johannesburg, South Africa was still under what was known as an apartheid form of government. And you'll remember that apartheid was where a white minority of people harshly ruled over a black majority of people in that nation. And so I went, and as someone who was white, I obviously lived with a white family, and I lived in a very affluent neighborhood, and I went to a very nice white school, and I ate at whites-only restaurants. I remember riding on whites-only trains, while the colored and the black Africans lived in their own segregated townships. They lived in Soweto or Alexandria or something like that. And even as I shared that story, it seems so foreign. It seems so crazy to even talk about that kind of time. But as a high school student, it was just explained to me as normal. And there were reasons that were given for this. And so what was explained as normal just seemed normal until you started to hear the stories of people. And I remember getting to know some of the African people that lived there. Some of them were even, you know, the maid at our house or the gardener at our house, and to hear their stories. I remember reading more and hearing more stories. Years later, I've had the privilege to go back and visit that part of the world on several occasions and to hear stories of people that grew up in those times. And slowly but surely, as I listened and as I learned and as I understood experiences that went beyond my own, suddenly those blind spots started to fall away. In fact, God in His providence, one of the reasons that our church, I believe, has been so involved in that part of the world, primarily in Lesotho, is because God planted seeds in me even at that time, that there were people there that he loved, people there that were created in his image and were valuable. If we could only listen, if we could only learn, if we could only hear their stories. You know, when it comes towards moving towards healing the racial divide in our nation, we have to be willing to listen and learn from those that are different from us, and to be willing to hear a story that maybe you might even be skeptical about. James, Jesus's brother and the apostle, says it like this: you should be quick to listen and slow to speak. But in our world, everyone wants to speak first and everybody wants to listen second. And so this means we need to be willing to read, and we need to be willing to listen to accounts of people of color and to hear their experiences and to acknowledge them, even if we've been blind to them before. You know, one of the great characters in American literature history, one of the greatest of all, is Atticus Finch. Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird is the white lawyer who defends the black client. And Atticus famously says to his daughter, Scout, these words. He says, "Scout, you never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view, until you climb into his skin and walk around in it." And we would do well to look at the people that we so quickly put in our outgroup and try to consider and understand things from their perspective, to, if we could, get in their skin and walk around a little bit in it if we can. And so we need to acknowledge our blind spots. And one of the best ways we can do that is by listening and learning, even from people that are different than us. A second thing that we can do to move towards healing these racial divides in our nation is we can be people, as followers of Christ, that show honor to all people as image bearers of God. So we know that Jesus gave his life for all people of every nation, language, and tongue, because all people across time, across geography, across culture and language are all made in the image of God, and so all should be honored as such, right? And so we see this concept throughout the Bible. That's why we say racism is a sin against God's design, where all people were designed in God's image. And so we see this value that is placed on all people, whether it's the widow or the orphan or the alien among us, that all people are all valuable and made in the image of God. And this is a biblical concept. But we also see that throughout human history, that this good and biblical concept is picked up in some of the great thinkers and some of the great documents literally throughout history. And right now I'm thinking particularly of the United States Declaration of Independence. The United States Declaration of Independence says this: "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. They are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and among those rights are the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." And so what that is saying is that all men are equal and they have these rights. Why? Because they are given by their Maker, the Creator who created them, gave them those rights. And so they're meant to be there. They're image bearers of God. And so we should honor those things. That's why on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. in 1963, Martin Luther King stood up in front of 250,000 people to deliver the most famous civil rights address probably of all time. And before he talked about this amazing dream that he had, this is what Martin Luther King said. He said, "In a sense, we have come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, should be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." And what words of honor those are. And if we are ever going to move past the racial divide in our nation, we have to learn to honor all people as loved, as created, and as valuable to God, and therefore valuable to us. Each is a brother or sister worthy of honor. And then finally, just the last thing I want to suggest is we need to begin to see even those that are in our out-group, those that we look at as different than us, we need to begin to see them as our neighbor. So I had an interesting experience along these lines just a few months ago. I think I've shared with some of you before that my next door neighbor where I live is a Pakistani family that through the years we've gotten to know and consider friends. And so a few months ago, they were hosting a part of a wedding celebration, and part of it was going to be at their house. And so he invited us to come and to be a part of that. And so the day came for that, and I admit I came home that night, and I was pretty worn out, and I really just wanted to go home. But I also wanted to honor him. And so I would go over to this wedding party, and all of the men are separated from all the women. So all the women are in this room, and all the men are in this room. And I go into this room, and right away he gives me a cup of this Pakistani chai tea because he knows I love this chai tea. And so I start drinking that, and then before long someone else brings me this big plate of food, and everything on it smelled different and looked different, and most of it tasted really great, but it was just super different. And I sat down and I was eating this food and I was drinking my tea, and in the background there was a Pakistani television show that was on, and there was Urdu music that was playing, and there were probably 20 Pakistani men that were there. A lot of them were in traditional dress because it was a part of this wedding that they were at. And I looked around and before long realized I'm the only white guy in the room. And I realized I am in a different world. I mean, it was a cultural experience. I could have been on the other side of the world. And yet here I am about 50 feet, literally 50 feet from my front door. Because those people that in some ways seemed so different to me literally were my neighbors, because I love them and I care about them. Well, one day, someone comes up to Jesus and he says, "Jesus, what's the most important commandment?" And you remember what Jesus says. Jesus says, "The most important commandment is that you love God and that you love him with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind and strength." And then Jesus goes on and he adds, "And there's a second commandment, and the second commandment is like it." So in other words, if you do this second commandment, it's like you're doing the first one. If you do this thing, it's like you're loving God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the second commandment is this: you love your neighbor as yourself. And at least the way I imagine it, that most of the people that were standing around breathed a sigh of relief, because to them, their neighbor was the people that was in their in-group, right? The people that they related to, the people that they liked, the people that they felt connected to. And so someone asked Jesus another question: "Well, who's my neighbor?" And then Jesus tells this clarifying story. And you remember the story that Jesus tells. Who's ends up being the neighbor? The neighbor is not the person from the in-group. The neighbor is the person from the out-group. The neighbor in Jesus' story is the Samaritan, the one who people looked down on, the one who people at times even considered their enemy. Which means that Jesus was saying that we can never really love God more than when we're loving people in our out-group and when we're honoring people in our out-group. The Apostle John says it like this: it's impossible to hate your brother and claim to love God. He says, if you hate your brother and you say that you love God, you are a liar and the truth is not in you. And that's why Jesus had to go through Samaria that day. You see, Jesus had to go through Samaria, not because it was the shortest route, but because it was his mission to love and to honor all people. And as his followers, it's time that we do the same.